Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. Welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, how have consent decrees worked for other police departments across the country?
And how the Mexican state of Sonora has helped shape that country's politics.
But first, it's been 2 months since the Department of Justice released a scathing report into the Phoenix Police Department, finding systemic discrimination against people of color, people experiencing homelessness, and those with serious mental illness, as well as a pattern of excessive use of force and lack of accountability for officers. It was a bombshell for the city and the department, but city leaders have been reticent to enter into an agreement with the DOJ to fix it. It's called a consent decree, and it'd essentially mean the police department would be under the eye of the feds until it met agreed-upon requirements to improve. In the immediate aftermath of the report, most city officials said they couldn't comment on it until they had read the entire thing. They got it when the rest of the public and the press did. Phoenix Mayor Kate Gallego gave one interview at the time and declined to come on the show then to talk about it. But this week, she offered to come into our studios to tell us what's happened in the months since the report's release and what's next for the city and its police department.
We've had a lot of activity since then. I've had a variety of great and very useful conversations from stakeholders that include our dispatchers, who were mentioned extensively in the report, to just this morning, I sat down with two tribal police chiefs and a leader of a tribal community to talk about some of the components in the reports that mention Native American community. Mm-hmm. Several of my council colleagues have had listening sessions with their constituents and districts. So we're really trying to get out there and hear firsthand from the stakeholders who are mentioned in the report.
So it sounds like a lot of conversations going on right now in the months following this. What was your kind of personal reaction to this as mayor of this city when this came out?
It was a hard report to read. My challenge is to make sure we take this and use it to make the best department possible. We have been working to build the strongest department since I was elected to the city of Phoenix. It is important work, but it feels like work where we're going to have to keep evolving and keep pushing ourselves to do better.
So city staff has been reviewing things. It sounds like looking to verify specific incidents that were cited by the DOJ. Why go about it that way? Like, are you concerned that there are findings in here that are not accurate?
We want to have the best possible information. They refer to many incidents that are very well known in our community, but also some where we're not quite sure what they're referring to. We can make better decisions if we have all of the information possible. For example, if there's video, we'd like to watch it before we act. That seems like the responsible decision to make. Sometimes there's context that adds important information, and sometimes we just got to do better.
What do you make of the process here? Like, do you feel like the DOJ was transparent enough with the city throughout this? Like, would there have been moments in which you wish you were involved? There have been a lot of critiques of this. Do you have critiques?
They spent more than 1,000 days studying us without giving us feedback when they must have known things that they would recommend as early as the first year of the investigation. We would have benefited. We would have started working earlier, and maybe we could have had better outcomes. I would love to have more of a conversational process where we explain why we did certain things and can get back and forth.
Mm-hmm. So overall, these major findings from the DOJ of systemic discrimination against people of color, those with mental health problems, the people experiencing homelessness, do you agree with the findings of this report?
We know we have a lot of work to do. There was a lot of recommendations in the report where they wanted us to move more quickly in what we are already doing. We are very motivated to do that. Some of these projects are enormous changes in what we've been doing. For example, they really pushed us to do more on training and data collection, and we're going to step up and do that faster. I'm trying to use this to push some of our private sector vendors on the technology side. There's a real urgency. You know, we sometimes feel the vendors don't feel the urgency we do, and this is a tool for me to try to get results faster.
So I wonder, like, what kinds of conversations you've had with the communities who are really impacted here, right? Like the ones who are probably sounding the alarm that led to this, people of color, people experiencing homelessness, these mental health incidents and advocates there. Like, do you think that this is enough for them, this response from the city?
There are a lot of people in our community who want an immediate response. We feel the urgency they do and are trying to go as quickly as possible. I mentioned I had met with the dispatchers. The DOJ really pushed us. We needed to do better training for our dispatchers. We agree, and our dispatchers would like more training. Just this week, we've launched an effort to hire more dispatchers because if we're taking people off the phones, we need other people on the phones because you expect us to still respond to your 911 calls while we're doing all of this training. Mm-hmm. So we are working quickly to make those changes. If I could snap my hands and have dispatchers trained instantly, I would do it. But the truth is it's going to take time to hire folks and train them to meet our community standards. But we get the message loudly and clearly. Do it as efficiently as possible.
What about when it comes to discrimination, though? Like in those communities, do you think there's a real distrust of the police that needs to be rebuilt?
We know we need to work harder to build trust with our community. And long before DOJ came to the city of Phoenix, we've been putting policies in place. One of the first things I worked on as an elected official was body-worn cameras so that there'd be a real recording of what happened. We could learn, we could improve. It's not enough. We have put in place what we call an Office of Accountability and Transparency, which is non-police, what we call civilians, who will look at cases where people are frustrated and feel we didn't meet the standards. That office has been putting out reports that provide very helpful recommendations about how we can do better and point out where we have fallen short. We also began long before DOJ came here and committed to create a civilian review board. That is, people who don't have a police background who will look at the policies of our police department and help us improve.
Let me ask you about that, because there's been a lot of criticism there as well. Many have said that because of new restrictions on who can apply, right? Like you cannot have litigated a claim against the police involving use of force now, and other changes that were imposed by the state legislature, that this board is essentially toothless. Do you think that will be true? Do you think it will have power, investigative power?
The requirement is that you can't have an active litigation mm-hmm. involving the city of Phoenix or done so in the last 10 years. So it's not a ban on people who have had rough experiences with the police department. But if it's still ongoing, we want to get through that so that people can have a little more perspective and look citywide. It was a real balance. And we think we're going to have a board that will help us make great recommendations. There's not one policy that's going to fix this, but the Civilian Review Board is nationwide known as a best practice. And we think it'll make it a valuable contribution alongside the many other changes that we're making.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what's next here. Based on these DOJ findings, there's a lot of debate whether or not the city should enter into a consent decree. It seems likely that is what the DOJ is after here. It would mean essentially that the department would be under oversight of the feds. City officials before have said they are very against this idea. Many have said they do not want that to happen. Where do you stand?
I have spoken to a lot of my fellow mayors who've been involved with this. In particular, I have looked at what's happened at the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office. Mm-hmm. Just this week, another front page story saying they'd spent $250 million and the reporter couldn't find a single stakeholder who thought things were going well. Mm-hmm. A lot of frustration on both sides. It's my job as mayor to learn from everyone else's experience and try to do the best to keep Phoenix safe. What I've decided is we need to go full speed ahead with reform and recommendations. We will learn everything we can from DOJ. But these processes have been very costly and in many cases have not come out with great outcomes. I've talked to some of the mayors in Maricopa County for whom the sheriff is the law enforcement authority. Good progressive Democratic mayors who've said, this is a really frustrating process. We go to the sheriff, we want a change made, and we have to wait for a court monitor and a federal judge. It doesn't serve anyone well. Hmm. So I think the best is to really take those recommendations that we can implement, but also let our existing accountability mechanisms work.
Are you willing to go to court against the DOJ for this? That's basically the only other alternative, yeah?
We've had some conversations where there may be other alternatives. Many people have pointed us to Austin, Texas, where they were able to make very significant changes and improvements without having court oversight. We want results soon. I don't want to spend $250 million and have the result that the county sheriffs have. would be malpractice on my part to not learn from what's already happening in our community and try to do better. We are very much committed to building trust with our entire community. The Phoenix Police Department goes out on so many calls, and the vast, vast majority of them are successful, but that's not good enough. And so we will keep working.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. Phoenix Mayor Kate Gallego, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me back.
The Maricopa County Sheriff's Office is not in a consent decree, but it is under a court-appointed monitor due to the judge's ruling in the long-running Melendrez racial profiling case that goes back to the time of Sheriff Joe Arpaio. But it's true that consent decrees can be costly and they can take a long time. But our next guest says, based on her research into how these work across the country, they are effective. Rachel Marshall is the executive director of the Institute for Innovation in Prosecution at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. They aim to bring more voices to the table when it comes to police accountability and oversight, including creating a nationwide network of states' attorneys general to encourage them to take leading roles in this realm. She gave me an overview of what they've seen when it comes to consent decrees.
We've seen that consent decrees can really be powerful in terms of effecting real change within police departments. And just to give an example, in Chicago, the state attorney general, Lisa Madigan, former attorney general Lisa Madigan, sued the Chicago Police Department following the killing of Laquan McDonald and a finding by the Department of Justice federally of systemic misconduct by the Chicago Police Department, including racially disparate policing practices and widespread use of excessive force. Mm-hmm. And the DOJ nonetheless did not pursue a consent decree following the report, which came out a week before President Trump took office. And under President Trump's administration, the department made clear it was not going to pursue a consent decree. So Attorney General Lisa Madigan sued the Chicago Police Department herself in federal court, and it resulted in a really impactful consent decree that remains in effect today and that implemented changes like requiring officers to log every time they drop their weapon, to report their use of force data on a monthly basis, improving officer accountability procedures, and other things like that. But I think another piece of the picture that's so important and that is such a good illustration based on what happened in Chicago is the incredible level of community engagement that Attorney General Madigan included in the process. She had a series of different roundtables across the city where they really heard from voices of people in the city about how the police department had impacted them. And those voices were all included in the forming of the consent decree and really went really far in being able to create both change, but also buy-in from the community whose voices were being included and respected in not a tokenizing way, but in a really meaningful, substantive way to effect that change in the police department.
Yeah. So there's an example where it seems to have been successful. Are there examples in cities where it has been less successful and costly?
Well, certainly consent decrees have their limitations. We know that after a consent decree concludes, there have been instances of backsliding. So one example that comes to mind is Pittsburgh, where there was a consent decree that lasted 8 years and was really praised as a model of progressive policing, but expired in 2002. And afterwards, we did see that there were many violent incidents, including leading to about $5 million worth of settlements for claims against officers in just a 5-year period, about 8 years after the consent decree expired. So we know that it can sometimes be challenging to continue to maintain that progress. The other limitation of consent decrees is that they can take time in order to develop, and so they can take time to therefore effect the changes that they are seeking. And as you mentioned, they can be expensive, but I think it's important to put that in context. So, for example, I just mentioned Chicago. That consent decree cost the city over $25 million. However, those consent decrees often cost less than what a city would otherwise pay out from all the different suits that come about from officer misconduct. Mm-hmm. So looking at Chicago again, Chicago has paid over $700 million in police misconduct claims in a 9-year period. So it's really important to contextualize that cost and realize that that oftentimes the cost can be much higher without a consent decree. But overall, the impact of consent decrees has really been powerful. We've seen examples of that time and again. In Seattle, for example, there was a 2012 federal consent decree following an investigation by the DOJ under the Obama administration. And that investigation found a pattern of excessive force, racially discriminatory policing, And because of the consent decree, there were crisis intervention programs that emerged to respond to behavioral health crises. And there was a reported 60% reduction in use of serious force. Hmm. So that's pretty powerful change that we can see happening as a result of consent decrees.
So city officials here in Phoenix, following this DOJ report that came out just a month or two ago, seem very reticent to enter into a consent decree. They have cited cost, the amount of time it can often take, as you mentioned. But they've also said that there are mixed results in all of this. I wonder, when a city or, you know, a jurisdiction decides not to enter into a consent decree, what do those cases look like? What are the other options?
There are other options of other kinds of alternatives to consent decree that we've seen be successful. One example is there can be settlement agreements that are not court enforced, that they're reached outside of court. An example that comes to mind of a successful A settlement agreement was one that was recently reached last year in New York State, where the Attorney General, Letitia James, had sued the New York Police Department for its response to how it handled protesters in 2020 following the murder of George Floyd. And a settlement reached in 2023 really aimed to protect the public from some of those practices that the police were using in response to protests and making sure that they respected the First Amendment rights of protests and their safety. And that settlement agreement required the New York Police Department to modify practices and created a framework for how the police could respond to protests. Mm-hmm. But instead of having a consent decree involved and a federal monitor, it's overseen by a committee that includes First Amendment lawyers, civil rights lawyers, as well as police union representatives and members of the Attorney General's office. So that's another model, but typically and that's been successful in New York.
Yeah.
But oftentimes settlement agreements are better suited for more minor problems in a police department, whereas consent decrees really go to more systemic, widespread problems like the kinds that we've seen in Phoenix identified in the DOJ report.
All right. That is Rachel Marshall, Executive Director of the Institute for Innovation in Prosecution at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Rachel, thank you for coming on. Thanks for taking the time to talk through this and for your expertise here. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you, Lauren.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, how leaders from Sonora shaped Mexico for decades.
But first, hundreds of thousands of online articles from MTV News were taken offline earlier this summer by its parent company, Paramount. Some observers worried the content would be lost forever, but much of it is still available through the nonprofit Internet Archive. Mark Graham is director of the Wayback Machine at the Internet Archive and says the organization archives more than a billion URLs every day. Graham says there are lots of reasons why sites can go away. Some are benign, others less so. He joins me to talk more about this. And Mark, what goes into you sort of springing into action, for example, when MTV News' content went away? What is the process for your team to step in and try to save that stuff online?
Sure. Well, I mean, the process is that we are constantly archiving material, continuously archiving material from the public web, and we've been doing this for the better part of 28 years. So in actuality, there really was no springing into action. The springing into action started like decades ago. And over that time and on a continuous basis, we work diligently to archive large swaths of the public web. In particular, you know, with regard to the MTV News site, we have been archiving that probably since its inception.
Do you try to focus on content that is at risk of going away? Or it sounds like, like in the case of MTV News, you've been doing it for a very long time with no indication that content would go away.
Sure. Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I mean, the answer is yes and no. Yes, of course, we do try to focus on exactly the term you used, at-risk information, right? But one of the challenges is you don't know what you've got until it's gone. Mm-hmm. So how does one know what it might be at risk? In theory, anything that's digital or anything at all in any kind of format is theoretically at risk. But there are some things that you might suggest might be riskier, at more risk than other kind of things. Or at least you might also try to say, well, If we lost this, what might the impact be, right? Is it of greater significance culturally, historically, or in some other fashion? But that, too, is problematic because, right, I mean, one person's trash is another person's treasure. So the answer is, while, yes, we do actively pay attention to material that maybe is published by organizations or governments, et cetera, that, you know, might be at risk of going away. But at the same time, we try to focus on everything.
So what to you is the importance of saving all of that content? I mean, you mentioned, you know, one person's trash is another person's treasure. So
sure.
You never know who is going to find what interesting or important. But when you're taking, you know, MTV News versus, you know, maybe something from a political organization or from a religious
right.
organization or a civic organization,
sure.
like what's the importance of having all that?
Yeah. Well, I guess the importance is because if it goes away on the web, and, you know, there's any one of a number of studies that I could cite. There was a new one or a recent one from Pew Charitable Trust that looked at a collection of URLs from about 10 years ago. And they found that for that particular collections, more than 30% of those URLs were no longer available on the public web. So one way of saying that would be that about a third of the web from this particular collection from 10 years ago is gone. It's inaccessible. The good news is that when we then looked at those URLs, we had archived fully two-thirds of them. So new headline. Instead of saying a third of the web is gone for that particular set, we could say only a ninth of the web. But that's still a ninth of billions and billions of things. So these are pretty big numbers. So I would say the answer would be we archive this material so that for future generations and for researchers today even, the material that might otherwise not be available is accessible, is discoverable, is useful to people. And that's our North Star.
I want to ask sort of a philosophical question, which is, you know, for a lot of people, we hear about the, you know, if you post something online, it's there forever, you know, mostly trying to scare younger people not to, you know, take pictures of them doing stupid things, you know, that their prospective employers will then find when they're doing a quick search. But based on what you're saying, that doesn't really seem to be the case. Like, how do you sort of jive the two things that we're hearing at once, which is, you know, online is forever versus, no, it's really not?
Well, a lot of things that we're told aren't true, right? And and so some things are going to persist and other things won't. There is not necessarily a rhyme or reason to it. Who remembers their MySpace page, for example,
yeah.
or could access it? GeoCities. I mean, there was a time when we thought that's all the rage. And these areas, these digital environments that people were investing so much energy into would be around forever. Well, no. But by the way, you can find almost all of GeoCities from the Internet Archive. So, yeah, I don't know. It's kind of funny. We were told that we were building web pages, and it's almost kind of a cruel joke to think of this, you know, metaphorically as a page. You think of a piece of paper, which actually paper is pretty persistent. For not the least of reason is because we tend to make lots of copies of things that are on paper and then spread them around. So even if one library burns down, for example, there's often another library they would have a copy of the book. But these are pages and concept only. I mean, these are, you know, bits that live on hard drives that are spitting really fast and sometimes crash. So it's a bit of a hit or miss, and some things that people think might be around for the millennia, maybe not so much. Can I tell one particular story?
Of course.
When the Malaysian airliner was shot down over Ukraine a few years ago, there was an individual who uploaded onto a VK, which is kind of the Russian version of Facebook, it's a social media platform, a claim that they had just shot down a plane and with a picture of a smoking ruins in the plane in the background. That was taken down within a day. Taken offline, probably by the person who posted it, after they realized what they had posted and what they had done, but not before it had been archived in the Wayback Machine. So that particular post is still available in the Wayback Machine, and the individual who posted that was one of the three individuals that was found guilty of that crime by the courts last year.
That is Mark Graham, director of the Wayback Machine at the Internet Archive. Mark, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
College was never supposed to be the best time of my life. At least I never entered freshman year with that thought process. I wanted to get in and out of the university as quickly as possible. Those are the words of Abigail Beck, a journalism major and rising senior at ASU. Earlier this year, she published a letter to her teenage self in State Press magazine, hoping to counter the generalized advice about college she remembers reading when she was 18. Now 21, she's been reflecting on what she thought her college experience would be like and how different those expectations were from what it's actually become. As we enter the late summer period, when thousands of incoming freshmen descend upon the ASU campus, Beck sat down with the show's Sam Dingman for a conversation about the parts of college life that no one prepares you for.
I went to a very accelerated high school. We had like all honors program, all advanced placements, and there was a lot of pressure on just being the best and doing the best. And I carried that pressure very quickly into college. And I was like, okay, I just want to do the best that I can. I want to get out in the field and I want to like do hard journalism and I want to get there quick. I definitely, when I came in, I was like, oh, I'm going to ace this. It's going to be easy. Mm-hmm. Like mm-hmm. just a few, a quick 3 or 4 years and I'm out of here, you know?
Well, so at some point in kind of tracking your narrative through the piece, you go from this feeling that this is this 3 to 4 year task that you're going to accomplish, you're going to achieve it, which is a lot of pressure to put on yourself.
Yeah.
To then putting a lot of pressure on yourself to make the most out of college. You've got to go out. You've got to make friends. You've got to have really good grades. And that all of a sudden feels like something you need to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
How did you find balance between those impulses?
I didn't for a while.
Okay.
I didn't. I would spend time with my friends, but the thing is I'd be thinking about all the schoolwork that I had to do. And it was kind of just this like really suffocating perspective to have, to really hold yourself to those standards. And I think that a lot of people do that because especially in my major, I know it's true for a lot of other majors, there's a lot of pressure to really be in every single like form of journalism clubs, and you should take them all and head on, and you should be an editor in all of them, and you should just always be thinking journalism 24/7. And I think that started to get to me too. Trying to give 100 to everything all the time is never going to work. But it kind of had to hit me hard before I had to realize that.
Well, not to make an obvious or cringe-inducing segue here, but I know that at one point you were involved in a car accident.
Yeah.
You write about this in the piece.
Yeah.
And it seems like that was a pretty transformational experience for you.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was actually driving to do an interview for a class that I had, a reporting class. And I was driving early in the morning and I never drove at that time. And I was in my car that I really loved. It was a 2009 Jeep Commander. It was my mom's old car. And okay. I loved mm-hmm. that car. And but I basically got rear-ended really bad. My car was totaled. It was done.
Oh, wow.
Immediately after. One of the tires came off. The headlight came off. Like,
wow.
Yeah. And so I was really grateful to that big, giant car for protecting me. But I was also thinking, what if I had been – like, my first car was much smaller. It was a Chevy Spark, and it was yellow. And I remember thinking to myself, I was like, what if I was in that car? And so I realized from that to – slow down a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't talk about this in there, but actually a few months later, I was walking downstairs in ASU's Memorial Union. I missed a step and I broke a bone in my foot.
Oh my God.
But instead of like that making me so upset, I kind of made a joke out of it, honestly. I had a boot on and everything, and I was kind of just like, oh, you know, well, I have to style this, I guess, with my outfits, but, you know, I have to take it off when I drive, which is annoying, but... And so I think that has helped me a lot. And it's really just helped me to, like, appreciate where I'm at in life instead of constantly thinking about the next thing, the next thing, the next thing, because that's my problem.
Yeah.
And kind of being where my feet are, not to be cliche, but.
That doesn't sound cliche at all to me. I mean, that's the reason I'm really interested in this incident that you shared, because, you know, I hear you telling in your story, you're saying that you got there and you were like kind of already living in the future. You were already at the end mentally. Mm-hmm. And then you got into this place where you were in the present, but you were in like too many different presents at the same time, like class, friends, grades, all of these things. And it seems like this incident put you in this place of realizing like, oh, this is also my life.
Yeah.
And if I may, it made me think of a piece of advice that my dad gave me when I went to college that came back to me in reading your piece, which is he said, you have to remember you also live there.
Yeah.
And for that reason, one of the details that you shared in the piece that just really stuck out to me is you say now the best part about college is you go grocery shopping, you clean your apartment, and I don't know, to any of the 18-year-olds that may be listening who are about to go to college, those things probably don't sound pleasurable. But that's such an important lesson of growing up is that what's appealing about those things, I think, is the sense that you're in your life. You are taking care of yourself. You're doing these things.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of beauty to be found in the mundane tasks that you do. Just enjoying the things that make me feel like I'm not playing adult anymore. Instead, I'm actually being an adult.
Yeah. I mean, you came in, it sounds like, and I did this too, with this idea of like what an adult does. And here you are with this much different interpretation and experience of what an adult does. But, you know, as evidenced by the fact that you're going to be the managing editor of the State Press next year, it's not like you had to give up on your dreams in order to become this different kind of adult.
Yeah. And I think, you know, these big things happen, but little things happen too. You know, like friendships fall apart.
Yeah.
You know, you date people and then you break up with people. And things are constantly changing when you're at this age. And it's not going to stop. It's just starting. And I think I realized that pretty quickly too.
I guess as a last question, I'm wondering, having cultivated all this self-awareness, gone through all these experiences, do you feel like you're looking at the next phase of your life after graduation differently than you were looking at your future when you came into ASU?
Yeah, I think so. Because I'm not trying to like rush anything anymore. You know, graduating and entering the career field or grad school, I don't know what I'm going to do. But whatever next.
There it is right there. You don't know what you're going to do.
Yeah,
that's great.
Yeah. And I don't really know, but I'm okay with not knowing. And I think that's the difference, is not having this like 5-year plan of this is what I'm going to do and this is where I'm going to go and this is the city I'm going to live in and this is what my life's going to look like. Because I didn't think that my life would look the way that it does now. And maybe if I'd seen it when I was a freshman, I'd be like, God, she's kind of boring sometimes. But I'm not boring. I'm just content. I'm just kind of walking through life rather than trying to sprint it out.
Well, one thing that we do know the future holds for Abigail Beck is that she will be the managing editor of State Press going into this year and is a former reporter at State Press Magazine. Abigail, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. After the Mexican Revolution in the early part of the 20th century, leaders from the state of Sonora started rising to prominence in that country, and those leaders from the northern and western part of Mexico started moving the country in a different direction. Jürgen Buchanan explores all this in his book, The Sonoran Dynasty in Mexico, Revolution, Reform, and Repression. Buchanan is a professor of history and Latin American studies at UNC Charlotte, and he joins me to discuss. And Jürgen, why is it that so many Mexican leaders, especially in the last century or so, have come from this one state and region?
So first of all, of course, the Northwest in Mexico used to be very remote from the national political scene. So in the 19th century, there was only one Sonoran who played a large role in Mexican politics. And similarly, you had very few people from Chihuahua, from Nuevo León, from Tamaulipas. Most of the political center of gravity in Mexico was really in the center and south throughout the 19th century. So the ascendance of Sonora in the early 20th century was a little bit of a novelty, a little bit akin to the fact that the West and the United States didn't have any presidents either until the 20th century, when, of course, then you had Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan being two presidents from California, and you had Barry Goldwater from Arizona launching a rather credible candidacy in 1964, and then John McCain in 2008. So in many ways, the two countries mirror each other in that their traditional center of gravity used to be farther east, in the Mexican case, farther south. And so the story of my book is the emergence of this Northwestern faction as the first of its kind, really, in Mexican history.
What led to that? Like, did something change about the country, or did something change about Sonora that allowed these prospective leaders to become actual leaders?
I think one very big factor is the emergence of the border between the United States and Mexico as a major economic engine. So if you look at the border in the early, in the late 19th century, say in 1880 or 1885, very few people lived there, especially very few people lived in the Mexican part of the desert. But then, of course, when the United States industrialized and started really taking possession of the West, and by taking possession, I mean building infrastructure as opposed to just seizing the area from Mexico, as it had done in the 1840s and 50s, these railroads and other infrastructure that they built then also started extending south to Mexico and connecting to Mexico City and the mineral wealth that Mexico's north had. So I think that changes a lot. It triples the population of Sonora in a matter of 30 years. So this autonomy that Sonora had leads a group of farmers and other people from wealthy or middle class, largely white backgrounds, to build up a lot of power of their own in the late Porfiriato.
Well, and as you write, it seems as though those leaders, the Sonoran leaders, had maybe a different vision for Mexico than what previous leaders have had.
They definitely did. In many ways, these are men of the frontier, just like you have people from the frontier dominating politics in the territory of Arizona or in the state of California during those years. So these are people who basically interpret the wide open spaces in which they find themselves as licensed to assert their autonomy. So they tend to be more individualistic. They tend to be more likely white. They tend to be landowners of their own, so not work on somebody else's land. They tend to be very anti-church. They tend to believe more in science and progress and reason than in whatever the church teaches. And so in many ways, they are not like the Mexican heartland.
Has this sort of relationship and maybe shared vision to some extent of the Sonoran leaders in Mexico and, as you described, the Western leaders in the U.S., has that impacted the relationship between the U.S. and Mexico, or even the Western parts, at least, of those two countries?
I think it did in a way. As I describe in the book, the United States and Mexico actually had some fairly significant conflicts during the time of the Sonoran rule, and that came from the 1917 Constitution, which basically gave the Mexican government the power to seize and nationalize lands and foreign properties that didn't follow Mexican laws. Now, what's interesting is that these Sonorans, even though they're very nationalist, because they're Mexicans from the border, and so they don't like the idea that the U.S. impinges on Mexico, wants to take over Mexico. But on the other hand, they're really familiar with the United States. The reason why that's important for the U.S.-Mexican relationship is that the Sonorans understand that the true center of gravity of the relationship between the United States and Mexico are individual people and organizations and companies rather than governments. So they understand that ultimately the governments follow what the people do. And so what the Sonorans are very wise and very smart at doing is that during this time of conflict, they cultivate Americans. So I think what's really unique about and new about the Sonorans is that even though they officially, in their government policies, pursued policies that we can call very nationalist and sometimes even anti-American, they realized that we're the neighbor of the United States. It's that we're only going to do things together. And so they appeal to these human relationships and put quite a little bit of social capital into developing relations with individual Americans, particularly important Americans, whether that's an industry leader like the banker Lamont, or whether it's Charles Lindbergh, who flew to Mexico City.
Well, I'm wondering if you see any of that now in 2024, either obviously not the same personal relationships, but the same kind of relationships maybe between individuals or between, you know, different entities within the two countries, helping to sort of figure out and forge what that American-Mexican relationship is going to be.
I can definitely see it today and in general in the last 40 or 50 years that there's realization on both sides that politicians will say all kinds of things to get votes, but that the political reality between the two countries is very different.
Do you get the sense that Arizona and Sonora are as close as they are because of some of the maybe shared history of emerging as power centers at maybe around the same kind of time?
I think there's no doubt that Sonora and Arizona are tied together. Of course, in the Porfirian era, they were rivals in a way because they were both copper producers. Mm-hmm. But then, as you know, after World War I, you have the Green Revolution in the U.S. Southwest. So you have the emergence of the Southwest border, and more so California than Arizona, as major food producers. But what you also have for the first time is mass Mexican immigration to the United States. And so it's natural that Arizona in the 1920s will receive immigrants, particularly into the copper mines, from Sonora. So I think since then, and then especially more recently with the maquiladora industry, these relationships have been very close and very important. And how close, I think we can see when things happen that interrupt the flow.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Jürgen Buchenau, a professor of history and Latin American studies at UNC Charlotte. His most recent book is called The Sonoran Dynasty in Mexico, Revolution, Reform, and Repression. Jürgen, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
You're most welcome.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Back in the 90s, Phoenix writer Mark Athatakis was feeling adrift. He'd just graduated from college and was trying to figure out where he fit in the world. A friend suggested he should check out The Manual by the Roman writer Epictetus. Epictetus was a firm believer in Stoicism, a centuries-old philosophical framework that's more popular than ever these days, thanks to a constellation of social media influencers, YouTubers, and podcasters. Mark wrote about Stoicism's resurgence in the Washington Post, and earlier this year, he spoke with the show's Sam Dingman about why this ancient school of thought first resonated with him.
Its largest prescription was that you were pretty much on your own, that you were training yourself to understand that death was coming for you, death was coming for us all, and that we were supposed to bear it and bear whatever negative things happened to us in the course of our lives.
Wow. So I have to say, you know, just thinking about my own state of mind after I graduated from college, which was not so long after you did, I think that sentiment of you're on your own, like it's as overwhelming as you think it is, mm-hmm. would have been totally paralyzing. But you did not feel that way.
I think it is a philosophy that appeals to introverts. I mean, Marcus Aurelius has – I'm trying to find the family-friendly way of describing it. But he will describe, you know, sex as just an exchange of fluids, that love is something that is mainly a distraction. And often some of the more severe Stoics would say that, you know, if your spouse dies, if your child dies, you should not be thinking of it as any much different than as if you've broken a jug. That you should learn to just accept that things are going to break, lives are going to end, and the best thing that you can do is just accept.
But I can see there being something very appealing about that practice of acceptance. And especially at a time in life when you are being forced to countenance, maybe for the first time, that mm-hmm. we exist in chaos, we mm-hmm. exist in mystery, we have no control over what's going to happen, including the worst things we can imagine, like death. Mm-hmm. And that's the baseline.
Oh, absolutely. And I think there's no doubt that part of the reason why Stoicism in its current form is so appealing, there is a certain comfort, and I think this is what the modern Stoics take advantage of. that, you know, here is somebody who is writing from a position of moral certainty and attempting a total awareness of the negative things that can happen in our lives and is trying to draw up a way of managing your way through it that is sensible, practical, and that keeps us from losing it emotionally.
In your piece, you kind of marvel at this, let's say, call it a renaissance mm-hmm. that Stoicism is having. Mm-hmm. And the particular folks who are at the forefront of propagating these ideas. Mm-hmm. So give us some examples of who those folks are and how they're deploying these ideas.
Well, I think you can't have a conversation about Stoicism today without talking about Ryan Holiday, who developed this cottage industry around Stoicism, where he is deliberately popularizing and simplifying Stoic philosophy and really trying very hard to distill it into more of a self-help philosophy. The Daily Stoic, I forget how many millions of followers it has on Instagram, but it is built on a lot of those sort of like kind of two-sentence quick-hit memes about, you know, that Marcus Aurelius or Seneca or Epictetus might deliver. And it doesn't get too much into the harsh stuff in the same way that, you know, maybe sometimes a lot of church sermons don't get into the really dark stuff in the Old Testament. It becomes this sort of like profiles in courage, like just recommendations about here's how great leaders and great people managed to achieve what they did. And it seems very simplistically prescriptive.
Yeah. Well, one of the interesting tensions that I was fascinated by in your piece is there's this idea in vintage Stoicism of moral excellence mm-hmm. as a sort of universal value. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that Holiday a lot of the time is writing about commitment to one's own moral compass at all costs, which is sort of a different idea.
Yeah, there is a certain sort of ruthless vibe. This is where the Ryan Holiday philosophy sort of drifts into the world of the Tony Robbins seminar, that there is a lack of grit or there is a lack of awareness of your need to stop whining and, you know, get to it. And that's a little bit different from arming yourself to be ready for having a difficult life. It's a little bit of a flip from that.
Two other versions of this modern iteration of Stoicism you actually have concrete examples of here in front of you. Can mm-hmm. you tell us what those are?
I'm sure. I am looking at a copy of Stoicism for Dummies. and this came out in January. And so when I saw this, that was the thing that prompted me. Is like, you know, have we achieved peak Stoicism now that we have like an official manual for the manual? The second thing that I'm looking at, and this came out around the holiday season last year, is a deck of cards that is published by the School of Life, which you may know. They do various YouTube videos, and they put together a deck of cards that is just – it's a black and white deck called Stoicism, and it is filled with quotes from various Stoics of the ancient sort with some explanatory material as well. So
do you recognize any of the Stoicism that you were once drawn to in these sort of watered-down versions of it that people are engaging with now?
I think to the extent that all of this, everybody who is doing Stoicism today, it's trying to get away from the death-struck notion of classic Stoicism, which, to be fair, you know, Marcus Aurelius was writing as a one-time war general and at a time when life expectancy was much shorter. Death was coming much closer to your life at that time. So I think maybe people are looking for a counterweight to the doom scrolling, that you know, you are inflicted with all sorts of bad news, negativity, et cetera, et cetera. So it doesn't behoove the modern Stoic to say, well, death is coming for you. Did you know that? So the memes are a little bit more about, you know, kind of girding yourself, and it's more spine straightening sort of stuff.
So to wrap up, I have the deck of cards that mm-hmm. you brought into the studio here, and I'm just going to draw one at random.
Okay.
And I'm going to hand it to you and have you read it to us and ask for your reaction
sure.
to it.
All right.
So I'm flipping through the cards.
I like how we're treating this like poker.
And let's go with this one.
Okay. Very good. So what do we have here? We have a quote from Seneca. "Winter brings on cold weather, and we must shiver. Summer returns with its heat, and we must sweat. We cannot change this order of things. That which you cannot reform, it is best to endure. And so this is Stoicism at its most Spock-like, right? You know, this is things are going to happen. The world has its order. You can't shake your fist at God and say that it needs to be different. You're just going to have to learn how to, you know, accept things as they come. So, you know, not necessarily bad advice. But again, you if you want to get all in on these guys, you have to get along with the notion that you have to perceive your wife as no different than an earthenware jug. Or that if a child dies, that it's just, well, that happened.
But of course, there's another key irony here to this social media stew where folks are encountering these ideas, which you write about in your piece, which is that one of the principles of the original Stoics was, and I quote, never be keen to please the crowd.
Yes.
So like this stuff was not supposed to be popular.
No, it was not supposed to. It was not supposed to be popular. It was supposed to be taken with, you know, a measure of disinterest. It was always very skeptical of the wider world. It was always very skeptical of what the crowd was thinking. And so you were always supposed to be girding yourself against that.
That was the show's Sam Dingman speaking with Phoenix writer and book critic Mark Athatakis.
All right, that'll do it for this Thursday edition of the show. Mark will be back with you tomorrow morning with the Friday newscap and much more. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening.